Okay, so welcome back. Quick reminder that if you have a cell phone, please put it in the silent position. So we don't want it to ring during class. And please do this every time so I don't have to remind you. Okay, so most of you who have filled add drop form should now be registered. And since there were quite a few, I would urge you to go check your status on Spire. Make sure the course is showing up. If not, let me know. Okay. Let's continue where we left off last time. So there were a few slides that we couldn't cover from lecture 1. I'm going to finish those and then switch to the material for today. So we were I started with an overview of what are distributed systems, what are their advantages and disadvantages. And then we were talking about the history of how distributed systems have evolved over time, the various models that have been used in practice, and we started talking about this notion of an operating system, specifically how a distributed operating system differs from a uniprocessor operating system. So as I had said last time, an operating system is basically an arbitrator for the hardware resources on the machine. It essentially provides an abstraction of a simpler to use virtual machine to its end user. Okay? And a distributed operating system is not very different from a uniprocessor operating system in that it basically provides the abstraction of a single centralized resource to the end user, okay, which is exactly what a uniprocessor operating system also does. Okay, so in some sense, it looks like a centralized OS, but it is running or executing on multiple independent CPUs, multiple independent machines, and yet providing a centralized OS abstraction. So there are various flavors of a distributed operating system that start from the very strict definition, and there are others that basically weaken this definition in some form. And this table lists the three main categories of what we would call a distributed operating system. Okay, the first one is the one that I already mentioned, and we'll refer to this as actually a distributed OS. It's a tightly coupled operating system that either runs on multiple processors or multiple homogeneous computers. Okay. So it basically hides the presence of the multiple CPUs, be they on single machine or multiple machine, from the end user. Okay. Now we contrast this with what we'll call a NOS or a network operating system. Okay, in this case, the coupling between machines is more loose. Okay, in this case, there's a tight coupling. This is a loosely coupled OS that runs on multiple machines that are interconnected over a LAN or a WAN. So essentially, a network operating system is what you have on any machine. Okay, it's basically a uniprocessor operating system with networking support on it. That's essentially what a network operating system is. And as you can see, a network operating system does not hide the presence of multiple machines on the network. So if you are in a LAN environment, you have networking capabilities. You can access resources on the network, but the OS itself doesn't hide it. So in other words, if you want to access resources on another machine, you have to explicitly remote login or SSH into that machine. So you need to know that there's another machine and you need to access resources explicitly. A distributed operating system would actually hide the presence of all of these machines from you. Okay? So that's the key distinction between a distributed and a network operating system. Okay, and there's something that lies in between, which is called a middleware operating system. So what this does is it takes a network operating system, which is basically any modern operating system today, and it adds a software layer on top, trying to provide some of the functionality of what a distributed operating system would provide, but you construct that using a network operating system plus a software layer on top. Okay, and I'll show you a picture of what this does. So essentially, by doing so, you provide distribution transparency, which a network operating system does not provide, but a distributed operating system does. So let's now start looking at various flavors of this in a little more detail. So we start with multiprocessor operating system. Okay, this is a simple generalization of what a uniprocessor OS does, except that you manage multiple CPUs or multiple cores on your machine. Okay, again, any modern operating system that you have on laptops or desktops essentially is a multiprocessor operating system. Okay, this is because most machines that you buy today have multiple cores and the OS has to manage these cores. Okay, but the presence of these multiple CPUs is not directly visible to the end user. Okay, your applications may run in parallel and as a result you get better performance, but you do not really have to deal with the fact that there are multiple CPUs. Okay, this is what the OS does for you and it hides it from you. We will talk about how to schedule up threads and processes in a multiprocessor context later on in this course. Okay, that's where we will come back to this notion of a multiprocessor operating system. Okay, now, a multi-computer operating system, which is what our definition of a distributed operating system is, essentially looks like this. I already mentioned that there are multiple machines here. There's this OS kernel that is running on all of these machines. So logically, it looks like a layer that sits basically on what would normally be just a uniprocessor kernel. So this provides distributed operating system services, okay, and hides the presence of multiple machines from the user. Okay. So when a user application that executes on any of these machines essentially submits a job or a command, okay, where it is executing is hidden from the user. Okay. The OS may decide that a particular task that's submitted can run on a particular machine that's not local to where the task was submitted. So you may submit the job here, it may run somewhere else. Okay. You don't know, neither should you know in a distributed OS. Okay. So you essentially get what is called a single system image or a OS kernel that's hiding the presence of multiple machines from the end user. Okay. There are some flavors of Linux that have this enhancement that are designed to run on clusters. Okay. MOSIX is an example of this. Okay. MOSIX is basically OS image that's constructed using Linux as its core, which has this layer on top that hides the presence of the machines in the cluster. Okay. Yes, there's a question.
So whenever you're making a request to the distributed operating system for a resource, I mean, do you actually talk to one of those machines directly first to make the request, or is there another machine sitting somewhere that kind of routes the request to one of the different sides?
Right. So there's a question of how do you submit requests. So it's a bit of both. Okay. In some sense, you could have a machine that acts as a head node where you submit your request and then all of the remaining nodes are basically in some sense a slave node that the OS basically uses. Okay. You could do that. In some cases, you can access a machine in the cluster. Okay, and then that is the interface to the rest of the cluster that you have, and you submit jobs there, but the OS then takes care of distributing it.
Yes, if you have one machine you talk to submit a request, wouldn't that become a bottleneck in large clusters? Or
it's a question about whether that machine, the head node, is a bottleneck. Typically, the head node is just accepting and routing requests; it's not executing it itself.
It's so cheap that it can handle.
So, yes. So, since the heavy duty computation may be actually offloaded to other nodes, typically this is not a problem. Okay. There are simulation clusters or software that you use for simulation that basically operate in this fashion as a head node where you submit jobs and that goes and distributes it to other machines. Okay. So, with this picture, let me now show you what a network operating system looks like. So, as you can see, it looks very similar, except that the OS is not a logical layer that sits on top of all of the machines. So you take a uniprocessor kernel and you add networking support and you get a network operating system. This is what practically every OS, Linux, Windows, Mac OS does for you. Okay? The presence of other machines is not hidden from you. Okay? So your distributed applications have to be aware of the presence of other machines, resources on those machines, and how to use them explicitly. So if there's a component of your application running here, it needs to access a file that's stored somewhere else. You either have to use a network file system or you need another component there that communicate with this component and somehow pass the data back and forth. Okay? So in other words, the fact that you are distributed is not hidden from it. Yet, you can access remote resources. Okay? So it basically provides similar functionality but weaker abstractions in terms of transparencies. So, as I said, all modern operating systems are network operating systems. What is shown in this picture is basically a file system that is constructed using a network operating system. Okay? So this uses a request response or a client-server model where one of the machines acts as the repository of all the files. Okay, and that's called a file server, and other machines can access any file that is stored on this server. And this is done using a request and reply paradigm. Any application here wants to access a file there, it basically sends a request, the file server processes the request and sends back the response, which could be the file or the portion of the file that the application is interested in. Okay. This is how any network file system, including NFS, is constructed on top of a network operating system. And when we come back to the distributed file systems chapter, somewhere later on in this semester, we will look at this in a lot more detail. Okay, but this should just give you some indication of how you can access resources. In this case, resources are files that are stored remotely. Okay. Now here is a middleware operating system. Okay, so this basically takes a network operating system, which is basically this layer that I had shown you in the previous slide, and adds this middleware service layer on top. Okay. So it is trying to now hide some of the details that the middleware OS has, or rather a network OS has exposed to the application. Okay, but then rather than rewriting a new operating system, you make do with what you have and write this software layer, which is called a middleware layer, on top. So in other words, you could now go back to the distributed OS model, where the middleware service is responsible for taking jobs that are submitted and figuring out which machine to run it on. Okay, so you could take a Linux cluster and write this layer on top, and this runs on, let's say, a head node. Jobs come in, this layer then figures out which machines are idle and routes the jobs to those machines, gets back the responses of the computation and gives them back to the user. Okay. So that's what you can do with a middleware OS. So what I have on the last slide here, I'm not going to go into this in much detail, is basically a table that shows you various properties of a distributed OS, and there are two categories, what's a multiprocessor OS and a multi-computer OS, and then we looked at the network OS and the middleware OS. Okay. As I said, the big difference is the degree of transparency. A distributed OS hides the fact that there are multiple CPUs or multiple machines. A network OS does not, and a middleware OS uses a network OS to try to provide that transparency using that software layer again. Okay? So I'll look at this. If you have any questions, come back and ask me. Okay, what I'm going to do now is just move on to the material for today, which is lecture 2. Okay, so now what we have essentially done is gone through a quick introduction of distributed system, looked at what this course is going to be about, and that's essentially what's in chapter 1 of the book. Okay, so we are going to switch to chapter 2, but there's a question here, yes.
When sending, when figuring out which computer you want to run the task, do you take the length of the task and figure out if you want to run it on your local computer, because the bottleneck of actually transferring the data back and forth might be more?
Right.
So you take that factor of transfer into account? That's
okay, so there's a question of how do you decide whether to execute something locally or remotely. So, and you're asking whether you should consider the length of the job and figure out whether it's worth the trouble of actually transferring all the application and data. That's essentially what we will come back to when we do processors and scheduling. When we look at job migration and processor migration, these are the kinds of things the OS needs to know. What is the cost-benefit trade-off of running something locally versus paying the price of transferring the data and application elsewhere and running it remotely? You take the load into account, you take the overheads of doing this into account, and you make the right decision. That's what the scheduler is supposed to do. So when we talk about process scheduling in the context of distributed OS, this is exactly what we will look at. Okay, so in maybe 2 or 3 weeks, we'll come back to this problem. Yes.
So this paging also shared with the machines?
So there's question about how is memory shared.
Yeah.
Okay, so there are systems called distributed shared memory system that allow you to also share memory resources. Okay, all the picture I showed you was essentially about sharing either data or computation, which is the disk or the storage on the machines or the CPUs. We didn't really talk about memory there. There's a whole bunch of work that was done on this notion of distributed shared memory. Okay. Now, that said, no commercial system actually uses any of that. Okay, there's a whole body of literature, the old version of the book, not the first version, but there was one that was before that with a different title, actually had an entire chapter on this called Distributed Shared Memory. Since commercial systems don't employ these ideas, that material was dropped from the book and also has been dropped from the course. Okay? But the only thing that I will say about this is there is a way to share memory where you can take pages that are stored remotely and make them look like you have extra RAM on the machine, but the RAM actually resides elsewhere. So all of the RAM that is on your, on all of the machines in the cluster essentially look like they are available locally. Okay? But we will not actually look at how this is done in this course.
Well, that could be slow. We actually have
to patch
memory.
Yes. So the reason is the performance of these systems is so poor that they were never adopted commercially, and as a result, that body of work has not gone anywhere in terms of adoption. And performance was the big problem there.
You want memory to be fast, active, and then
yes, exactly. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is actually switch to chapter 2, and this is going to be another of these overview kind of chapters, but now more specific to architecture that are used for designing distributed systems or applications of various sorts. Okay, so we look at several broad categories of distributed systems or applications, starting from centralized to decentralized or peer-to-peer, hybrid, client-server, middleware-based, self-managing and whatnot. Okay, so let's go through them one at a time. Okay. So here is one way to categorize these various architectural styles. Well, this is broadly what does the architecture of a distributed system or application look like. Okay. So we look at what are called layered architectures, object-oriented or object-based architecture, data-centric and event-centric architecture. Okay, so there will be these four categories, and then we look at several modern ones that are some hybrids of these. Okay, so these are the basic categories, and we'll look at several others where some have combined these ideas in some way. So let's start with the layer design. Okay? So if you have taken a course on networking at any point, you will recognize this picture. It basically shows what is called a layered design for any system. Okay? Any protocol stack like TCP/IP stack is also built in the same fashion. Same ideas apply to how you can design a distributed application. So what this says, you basically break up the functionality of your application into layers. Okay? And these layers are stacked, and each layer can interact with either the layer above it and the layer below it, but no, nothing else. Okay? So interaction between components is restricted, okay, to a layered form. So if you are layer I, this layer, the software component running in layer I can only talk to layer I plus 1 or layer I minus 1. Okay? If you want to invoke any of the functionality of other layers, you have to go through these two layers, and then they actually invoke the remaining functionality for you, okay, recursively. So if you want to now use this architecture to process a request, okay, for instance, that is coming into your application, the request might arrive at layer N. It does some processing. It first either makes new requests or sends it down to layer N minus 1. Request trickles down all the way to layer 1. Okay, and then responses flow back up. Okay, so layer I or layer 1 sends its response to layer 2 and so on and so forth. Okay, we will come back to this architecture in just a moment. Okay, so multi-tier web applications that are in use today, as we'll see, actually use this layered design. And then I'll talk about a much more concrete version of this abstract picture in just a few slides. But that's a layered design. Okay.
Yes.
Is the OS designed or the application? So I don't think there are OS operating systems that are designed in this form, except for the protocol processing component of the OS. So if you have a TCP/IP stack implemented in the kernel, that would use this. Okay. But this is more from our perspective, it's more relevant for the application itself. Okay. So here is the object-oriented style. Okay, of designing a distributed application. So what happens here is you take your application and you again break it down into components. Okay? Each component is an object or a class. So think of your favorite object-oriented programming language, C++ or Java or any of these other object-oriented languages. And assume that you have now broken down your applications into objects. Okay? The only difference here is that these objects don't reside on the same machine. if you're a typical Java program, all of your classes might actually reside in the same process. In a distributed application, these objects may be distributed across a number of machines. Okay, so the functionality of your application is split across multiple machines. And these objects communicate with one another, okay, using a remote procedure call or a remote method invocation. Okay. Again, topics that we will come back to in chapter 3. Okay. But this is basically the architecture of your system. Okay. There are objects, and each object implements a certain functionality, and objects communicate with one another using method invocation. Okay. So if this object wants to invoke some functionality of some other object, it invokes a method call, okay, on that object. Okay. So in this case, it happens to be a remote procedure call or a remote method invocation. Yeah. Now, as you can see, this is basically somewhat of a generalization of the layer design, in that we are not putting any restriction on which objects can talk to which other objects. Okay. You could use the object-oriented style to also implement a layer design where each layer is an object, but here there is an additional restriction that each layer can only talk to the one above it and the one below it. The object-oriented style, there is no such restriction. So in some sense, it not only encapsulates the system as objects, it also loosens the restriction of which objects talk to which other objects. Okay. So now we come to yet another architecture, which is an event-based architecture. Okay. So in this case, the communication between components of your distributed application occurs through what are called events. So again, you take your application, you break it down into components, which are shown here. Components may run on arbitrary machines, okay, and they all communicate with one another using the notion of an event. Okay. To understand this, we basically think of this as what is called a publish-subscribe paradigm. Okay. So components in your system can either be publishers or events. Okay, publishers are producers of events, they produce events, or they could be consumers of events. Okay, these are components that consume events that others have produced for you. Okay, so this is how communication takes place. So if you want to communicate with some other component in the system, you would generate an event, and that event gets delivered to the other component. Okay, and then that component will process the event and do something with it. Okay. Now the way this works is, or the way the communication occurs, is using this module here, which we call the event bus. Okay. The event bus is the component that is responsible for connecting the producers to the consumers. Okay. So all the events that are published by any publisher or any produced by a publisher go to the event bus, and the event bus decides which consumer should be which consumer should take delivery of this event. And this is done using a subscription model, which is why it's called a publish-subscribe model. Each component can tell the event bus that it's interested in certain types of events. So they subscribe to certain types of events. Okay? And whenever an event of that type is produced by any producer, then the event bus will deliver it to you. Okay? So basically, this is a filtering mechanism. Okay. Rather than taking all events and giving them to all the consumers, which is a flooding model, you use this subscription model to filter out which events get delivered to which components. And this is how interactions between components occurs in event-based architecture. So it's very event-centric. Okay. Any questions here? We will come back to, again, this is just a broad architecture. There's an entire chapter on this that we will come back to later on in this course. Yes. Right. So this is just a different way of building your application. Okay. So it's not that there's one that's always going to be superior to the other. The way communication occurs here is through method calls. Okay. You call, make function calls, and you invoke functionality elsewhere. Okay. Here communication is occurring through events that are published. It doesn't have to be time based. You basically, if you produce a data, that can be published as an event. Okay? If you want to invoke some functionality, that can be published as an event. Okay? It's not timer based. Events don't mean that they are related to time. They could be, but they could be completely asynchronous. Okay? Yes, there's a question here.
One benefit to the event based architecture over the object based is that you can have multiple subscribers. In the object based, you have one method, one component. If you call it, it would go to the same machine.
Right.
In this point, you can have multiple subscribers, so if you send an event, it can go to any one of those.
Right. So what you're pointing out is an event could be delivered to multiple components. Okay, in an object-based model, you would have a single function call always goes to one object. So if you want to communicate with multiple, you have to make multiple method calls. That is indeed true. But coming back to your question of what are events, so events could be anything. I mean, so if this was a GUI-based application, a mouse click could be an event. Okay, and this is also an interrupt that is generated. But that, so there may be a component that's waiting for a mouse click, and when a mouse click occurs, then you deliver it to the event bus, and then it may be delivered to any component that will then process this mouse. This is a simple example, not a distributed application, but how event-based programming can be used even in centralized applications. Okay. Yes, question there.
But don't you need an event manager that is going to control your publisher?
Yes, that's the event bus. That's what we call the event bus. So this is the coordinator between the publisher and the subscriber. It's an important component that is going to connect the publishers to the subscriber. So
just a common data system where all the subscribers are and all the publishers are there.
No. I will talk about the data-centric architecture. This is not where things are published. This is basically where filtering occurs. Okay? So the events are not stored anywhere. Okay? Basically, events come in. This knows about all the consumers. It knows what consumers are interested in, what events, and this just delivers those events. That's all it is doing.
So
yes.
Now, because this event bus has been shared with all these components, so isn't there a bottleneck that's been provided?
Okay. That's so question is the event bus going to be a bottleneck?
Because this in the previous model, there is an individual communication going between two objects.
Yes. Yes. So think of this as a logical picture. Okay, I didn't say how this is implemented. It could be a single process sitting on one machine. All events from all machines come here and then they go out to the consumers. That will indeed be a bottleneck. Okay. Or you could have an event bus that is itself distributed. So each machine may have a component of the event bus, locally produce events, go to your local event bus, and then that knows about all the subscribers and that delivers it directly. Okay. So how it is implemented is not shown in the picture. This is just a logical picture. Okay. So you would indeed need to implement it in a way to avoid any bottlenecks.
I was wondering, as opposed to the object-based model, is this good enough for time-sensitive interrupts?
Is this good enough for interrupts? The interrupt model, an event-based model is also like an interrupt model.
Yeah.
This is a generalization of an event model interrupt model. Interrupt model typically works on a local machine. Okay, there are hardware interrupts or software interrupts, and then you do something to those interrupts. This is generalization of that works across machines. Okay. Because there is no, because we are interested really in a distributed system. Okay. So here is basically, that was an event-centric way of designing application. Here is a data-centric method for implementing an application. Okay. Again, here your application is split into components. Okay. But components communicate with each other by publishing and consuming data as opposed to event. But there's one important difference. I mean, at some level, events and data are not very different. They're just ways for communication. Okay. Data could be just a message, for instance. In this case, what we have is what's called a shared or a persistent data space. Is also called a bulletin board architecture. So whenever a component generates a data or publishes some data, it goes and it basically resides in this data space. It's not delivered to anyone. Okay? In an event-based model, whenever events are generated, you decide, you figure out who has subscribed to what kind of event, and you basically deliver the events to all consumers that have expressed interest in it. In a shared data space model, anything that is published doesn't get delivered anywhere. It gets posted onto a bulletin board. Okay, it's called a blackboard. Okay? And at some later point in time, components come and make queries on this bulletin board, saying, I am interested in this kind of data. Has it been published? Okay? And if so, then you basically take delivery of that data from the shared data space. So this decouples communication between producers and consumers. Then event-based model, as soon as events are published, they get delivered via the event bus to consumers. In this model, there is loose coupling. Okay? Anything that gets published, any data gets posted to this bulletin board. At some later point in time, other components come along and take delivery. Okay? Very similar from a physical bulletin board where you go and post notices. Okay? So you go and put up a note saying, I'm having a garage sale. And then you just leave it there. And some people come later saying, is there a garage sale? You look for all the notices and you say, okay, there is one here. Very similar to that architecture. This is more decoupled in space and time. Okay. And we'll again come back to bullet inverse architectures somewhere down course. There's a chapter on this, and specific system we'll study is what is called the Gini event, rather Gini shared data space system. Okay. This is something that's built on top of Java. So we'll come back to this later on in this course. But at this point, all you have to keep in mind is there are various ways of constructing a distributed application. Some are that are event centric, that are data centric, maybe be client server centric, and so on. Okay, any questions on this? Okay, so now let's come back to the more traditional client server architecture and try to see what are various ways of constructing them. Okay. So this is a picture that shows how a typical client-server interaction takes. Okay. The x-axis here is time. That line shows what the client is doing. This dotted line shows what the server is doing. So the client may be doing some computation. At some point, it needs to invoke a service. And so it sends off a request to the server. Okay. And then it waits. It waits for the response. The request traverses over the network, arrives at the server at some later point in time. Okay. The server then processes the request, generates a reply, sends it back over the network, and the client is waiting. Okay. It's not doing anything in this meantime. So that's why there's a dotted line there. Client receives the reply, continues computation. Okay. This is what is called the blocking model or a synchronous client-server communication model. Okay. Very simple, and all client-server or most client-server architectures, not all, use this model. Okay. Now, with this in mind, you have to ask the question, if you wanted to construct your distributed application, what functionality do you put here and what functionality do you put here? What do we call a client and what do we call a server? Okay. So to understand that, we have to understand what the application itself does. Okay. And there are three key things most applications do. Okay. There's a user interface component of the application. This is the part of the application users or people or maybe other applications communicate with this application. Okay. This is the interface to the application. Okay. There's a processing component, which is where the requests are being processed and you're doing something to all the requests or data that's coming into the application. And there may be a data level. Your application has persistent data, files or database. All that is taken care of that at the data level. Okay. So then the question is, in the client server model, where do you put each of this functionality? Okay. Do you put this at the client and these two at the server? Do you split it in some different way? Okay. Is this clear? Okay. So let me now illustrate several examples to show how this functionality can be split. Okay. Here is a search engine, okay. Very simple form of a search engine. Okay. It has, as is shown in this picture, three parts, okay. The user interface, the processing, and the data. Okay. The user interface in the search engine is essentially an interface like what Google would provide on a web browser. Okay. Basically, you have a form, you can type some keywords in the form and hit submit. Okay. That's the component. Okay. In this case, that component actually sits at the client, meaning it's running in the browser at the client. Okay. So the UI component of the search engine is executing at the client end in a browser. Okay. So assume that you basically sent off a keyword search. So it would then come to the processing component of the search engine. In this case, that part is running on what we will call the server. Okay. In most cases, this is not a single server, but a cluster of servers. Okay. So you have these keyword searches. Okay. The keywords come in, it comes to this component called the query generator. Okay. The query generator takes these keywords and actually constructs queries that you would then send off to a database. Okay. The database is essentially a collection of web pages that the search engine has crawled at some previous point in time and indexed. Okay. So what this would do is basically you would get all of these web pages, you will look at text in the web pages, you will find all the keywords or all the text and you will index it. Okay. So your keyword, your query generator would then generate a SQL query which you would send to the database, and the database is your data level in this case. Okay. Then you get back replies, okay, meaning all the documents that match this keyword are returned to from the database. And then you have a ranking algorithm that decides in what order should you present the search result back to the user. Okay, there may be many documents and you have some algorithm that says that this keyword is more important in this document than the other, so you order it accordingly. Okay, using some algorithm. Okay, so then you take this rank list of replies and you give it an HTML generator which takes this replies and construct an HTML page. Okay, and that is what is sent back to the user interface, which is the browser. Okay, then you get back the search results. Okay. So it's not important to understand any of the internal details of the search engine. What is important is how this application has been constructed from a user interface processing in the data level aspect. Okay. So the data level, as I said, is a database, a physical database. Okay. And all the processing is occurring here. Generation of queries, the ranking of the search results, generation of the HTML page that takes all of the results and sends it back to the user. And the user interface is very simple. It's a browser-based user interface. So the client-server boundary is essentially here. Okay, everything above this is in the client, and everything below this is in the server.
You can move it down, though. You can have the query generated to client, the HTML generated to client.
Right. So I'm just giving one example of where the division lies, and I'll show you a spectrum of how that boundary can actually move. Okay, any questions here?
Although, would it ever make sense to put the user interface in the server?
Right. So we'll
the data in the client?
We'll talk about that also in just one moment. There's a whole spectrum of these. Okay. So what this is also showing is what I refer to as a multi-tier architecture. Maybe I just mentioned this when we talked about the layered design. Okay. So in this case, basically, or what I showed you in the previous example, the client machine implements a user interface, and the server machine consists of the processing layer and the data layer. Okay. This gives us what we call a multi-tier architecture. And I'll show you some examples shortly. And what this picture is showing is other ways of dividing the functionality. Okay, the search engine way was essentially this, okay, where the user interface. So this dotted line shows the boundary between the client and the server. Everything above this is running on the client machine. Everything below this is running on the server machine. What I showed you in the search example case was this. Okay, the UI was here and the application and the database was here. But that does not need not be the only way you structure your application. You have this entire spectrum. Okay? So here is an example where the UI is itself split. Okay? Now where would you do this? So you may do this in scenarios where you have to do some error checking. Okay? You have a form. You fill the form. Okay, and you send it up to the server. The first thing the server does, even before it does any processing, is check whether all the entries are valid. Maybe the date format was not right, or you left a field blank. In this case, some of the user interface component is running here. Okay, it does maybe simple error checking and whatnot. And once you do go past that, then you have the application and the database. So this is one way to do this. Okay. Here, you have the application itself that is split between the client. The UI is completely on the client, but the application component is split between the client and the server. Okay. Now, where would you see this? So, if you have rich browser-based applications, for instance, the application may have some JavaScript, okay, that the browser is executing. So, part of the program is embedded in a JavaScript, or it could even be a Java applet. Okay. That is actually sent to the browser. It's integrated with the user interface. So you make some request, you already do some processing at the client end, okay, using your JavaScript or Java app, and then the rest of it executes at the server. Okay. Gmail, all of these are good examples of these. Okay, because you can actually do a fairly sophisticated stuff at the client end. You could have even an offline mode where if you are actually disconnected, because there is a network here, disconnected, the application is continuing to run. If you are in offline mode in Gmail, for instance, you can continue to work with your email even though you may not be connected, as an example. This is an example where part of the application is now in the residing at the client. In this case, it's in the browser. Okay. Here is yet another way to divide this. Both the user interface and the application is at the client and the database is at the server. Okay. These are what are called fat clients. Okay. These are not browser-based applications. Typically, you may have an integrated application that is running on your machine that has both the UI and all of the processing. And the only thing it is doing is whenever requests are made, you do the processing and then you send off queries to the database. So your database part of the application is running somewhere else, but the rest of the application is in your browser. Okay? Or not in the browser, on your client. Okay? And here you have yet another split where the database itself may be split. Okay? Some of the data may actually reside at the client end. This could be done for performance reasons. So this could just be a cache. It doesn't have to be an actual database. It could be just a cache of the data that's stored here. So frequently run queries can just hit the cache and you respond to them immediately. And infrequently accessed data, you have to actually go back to the database. Okay. So various ways of splitting your client-server application, okay, between the client machine and the server machine. Any questions on this? Okay, so what I showed you in the previous slide also gives rise to this three-tier web application where you again have the user interface, the processing and the data layers. Okay? And this is how most of your web-based applications that you see today are constructed. These are basic principles that underlie them. Okay? So the user interface, so basically that this is running, typically running at the client end, but not all of it. Okay, so you basically use a browser to interact with this application. You make a request and that is sent off to the server. Okay. Typically the server is a J2EE, a Java based server. Okay. So the user request arrives at the server. It could be a PHP based server as well, for those of you who know what PHP is. Okay. So you then process the request at the server. Okay. And then this request might require you to do a database lookup. So you basically send yet another request here. The database then does some processing, processes the query, sends back the reply. The app server then does some more processing, sends back a result. So just to give you an example, anything that you have basically, any web application that you access, online banking, Amazon, eBay, all of them use this basic functionality. Okay? So let's take Amazon as an example. Okay, let's suppose you go to the Amazon page, you type in a query on a catalog. Okay, so Amazon has a product catalog. Let's suppose you are looking for the distributed OS textbook. Okay, so you go to Amazon, you say distributed OS and you hit search. Okay, so that would then basically trigger a request. Okay, that would go to the server. Okay, the server has basically an HTTP front end, okay, which is accepting web requests. Okay, so basically your request is becomes an HTTP request that goes to the Amazon web server. So the HTTP server then basically takes this request, doesn't do much, it might do some simple checks, but then it sends it off to the application server. Okay? The application server may be written in Java or any other language, but let's assume it's Java. So then what this application server has to do in this case is take your catalog query, okay, and then do a product lookup in the Amazon's product catalog, which is stored in a database. Okay, so it would take distributed OS and construct, in this case, a SQL query, send it off here. Okay, the database server would then do a catalog lookup saying, what are all products that you have that match these keywords? Okay, and then maybe a list of books that all are on the topic of distributed OS might show up, and that is sent back to the app server. The app server is going to process them. Maybe it will order them based on popularity or price or discounts or whatever they want to do. And then it will construct a web page, okay, of this and then send it back to you. Okay. So you basically have these three tiers, HTTP tier, J2EE tier and the database tier. Okay. And most web applications have some form of these. And this is how you construct web applications. Now what's important here is to understand that this is essentially a layered design that I showed you. Okay. So basically each layer is talking to either the layer above it or below it. It's a three-layer design. Okay. There are only three layers in this, but this is essentially doing this. Requests are flowing down, responses are going up, back up. Okay. This is what I showed you in the layer design. Okay. Now there may be more than three, okay, because there may be more. Amazon is actually a more complicated app than what I just showed you. Okay. This is what a simple three-tier web application would use. Amazon may do more things. Okay. It may do authentication. It may have cookies that is process using to figure out where you are coming from and whatnot. Okay. So do to customize. So there may be more tiers here than just a single tier. Okay. Any questions on this? Okay, so now we are going to look at a completely different architecture, okay, not a client-server architecture, but what we would call a decentralized architecture. So in this case, what we have done is we have removed the distinction between a client and a server. Okay. There are components that all talk to one another, but they are neither clients nor servers, so we'll just call them peers. Okay. So rather than client-server interactions, you have peer-to-peer interaction. Okay. So all nodes are roughly equal in the system. Any node can talk to any other node. Okay, and this gives you what is called a peer-to-peer system. Now you may have encountered this in the context of large file downloads or music sharing and so on. They are all based on this architecture, but that's not the only application of peer-to-peer system. There are many others. Okay, the important thing to keep in mind is the distinction between a P2P system and a client-server system. Now there are many clients, P2P systems that have been designed. What this is showing you in this picture is a particular one called Cord. Okay? This is what is called a structured peer-to-peer system. Okay? And we look at several unstructured ones like Nutella as well. Okay? So what happens in this peer-to-peer system is that nodes can come and go. Okay? So whenever a node joins the system, okay, it has to pick a randomly chosen ID that another node hasn't yet picked. Okay, and these circles that are bold show you the nodes that are actually in the system and have picked an ID at any given time. So IDs can go from 0 to n, where n is a very large number. Okay, so you can pick an ID that no other node has picked yet. And then you join the system. You can think of the system as a logical ring. This is not the physical topology of the system, it's just a logical topology. Depending on which ID you pick, so if you pick 10, you are basically placed here in this logical ring. Okay? Now what does this also give? So essentially a peer-to-peer system implements what's called a key value lookup. Okay? Data items are stored in this system and each data item has a key associated with it. And you look up this data item by specifying a query that says, I want all items that match this key. Okay? Key could be a simple file name. So in your music type download scenarios, you specify a key which could be the name of the file and it goes and looks for all files that matches that key. Okay? But it could be anything a typical key value lookup. So data objects, okay, also have keys associated with them. And in this case, we'll assume that keys are just numbered. Okay, then they could be strings, but you can map strings to numbers. So let's assume that keys also go from 0 to n. Okay? So what the system has essentially given you is any node with a certain ID is responsible for managing keys for all IDs that surround it. So this node with ID 4 essentially is managing lookups for data items with key values 2, 3 and 4. This is basically the range from the previous node to this end. So this entire range of data items is managed by this node. Okay? So if somebody says, I want to figure out where is an object with key value 2, okay, that query is somehow routed to this node. Okay? And this node now also has information about where this object is stored. That's what the value of the lookup tells you. Okay? And then that is returned back to the user. Okay. In a peer-to-peer music download system, you may specify a file name, okay, that let's say it's file name 2, okay, rather than a string, you just think of numbers, and then that query comes here, and then what this node has is a list of all machines that have that file with it. So what is returned to you is all other machines in the system that are actually storing that file. Okay, then you can pick one and download from that file. Okay. Is this clear? Essentially what you are doing here is a table lookup. So there are keys which are basically what you are indexing on, and there are values. Okay? Typically values tell you where this object is stored and the key is the name of the object. Okay? And what this has done for you is basically a structured way of doing a distributed table lookup. This is also called a distributed hash table. Okay? Because different parts of the table, so if you had a centralized implementation, what you would have is basically one table where all the keys are stored. This is the location. So you have 2, 3, 4, and then this tells you this is, you have maybe have the IP address of the machine that stores this object or file and so on. So this is a centralized implementation of this table lookup. What we have done here is we have split the table into ranges, and each node there in that system takes responsibility for answering queries for all objects in that range. Okay? So this node is taken responsibility for answering all table lookups for data items 2, 3 and 4, and this one has taken 5, 6, 7 and so on. Okay, is this clear? What essentially we have in this structure?
So,
yes.
Do these nodes always exist in the system? What is there?
Yes. So we'll look at this in a lot more detail, but I was going to bring up this issue of CHR. Okay, now that's the basic concept. Now, way things are implemented in a peer-to-peer system, typical peer-to-peer system that you see in practice, is that these nodes are volunteer nodes. Okay, these are not nodes like in Amazon. Amazon sets up its own server that provides the service. In a peer-to-peer system, the service is provided in a voluntary fashion. You can decide that your machine becomes part of the system, and then it joins the system and takes responsibility for answering some queries for the value of the items with the values in your ring. Okay? Just as you can contribute a machine to the system, you can take the machine away as well. Okay? This is very different from typical client-server systems where servers are assumed to be always up. In this case, nodes can come and go. And all of this is arisen from this notion of music file sharing, where you're downloading some files and you're sharing some files with someone else, and you can take your machine off the shut down the application, and your machine disappears from this peer-to-peer system. Okay? And that's what gives rise to this notion of churn, where nodes come and go. Okay? In any peer-to-peer system, you have to deal with this notion of churn, okay? Because nodes are not stable. In a client-server system, servers are typically stable. They don't come and go. Okay, once the service is up, you assume that the service remains up. Okay. But then you have to deal with what happens when node enter the system, node leave the system. So P2P system, Cord and others have to deal with this. So here, there is an algorithm for joining and leaving. Okay. When you join the system, you pick a random ID that no one else has picked, and you join the system. So let's say you pick ID 10 and you join the system. Okay, then what happens is the responsibility for certain data item now comes to you. So if you join at location 10, then you take responsibility for 8, 9, 10. So you communicate with 12 and say you are dealing with all items from range 8 to 12. I am going to take over 8 through 10 and you keep 11 and 12 to you. So then you take over responsibility for this, and then you start answering queries. Okay? And if you leave the system, then there has to be an algorithm to know that you have left, and you reclaim that responsibility. So if 10 leaves, then 12 has to go back and take over responsibility for answering queries for 8, 9 and 10. Okay? And you need to have algorithms to do all of this, okay? Which we are not going to look at on right now, but we'll come back to. Yes?
If 10 leaves, then the data is lost, so you can't retrieve that data.
So question is, how do you ensure that data is not lost, or how to regenerate this data? That's all part of what a peer-to-peer system has to do. So you might replicate. So you might have to given responsibility for 10, but those entries are also kept somewhere else. So if there is churn and somebody leaves, you take over that responsibility. So you have to do things like that. Okay? We'll talk about what is exactly done somewhere later. But for now, I'm just providing the concept of what a P2P system is. Okay? So here is another one. So that was Cord. So this one is equivalent, but it does allow you two-dimensional lookups rather than one-dimensional. So this is called CAN, or Content Addressable Network. Okay, in the previous case, keys basically were integers that went from 0 to n. Okay, here keys are pairs of integers, x and y. Okay, and you do lookups by specifying a pair. So what happens now is basically your lookup space has become two-dimensional. Rather than looking up for some objects 0 through n, you have two-dimensional lookup. So in the abstract, you can assume that key values go from 0, 0 to 1, 0. So they are real numbers, and they are 0, 0 to 0, 1. And you can look up any object in this space. Okay, let me give you some intuition of why multi-dimensional lookup makes sense. Okay. So in the single-dimensional case, let's say you are looking for a file name. Let's say you're looking for file foo, okay? And you send this query off, and all files that match have name foo or the keyword foo in them will be returned, okay? And these might be different types of files. They may be images, they may be audio files, they may be something else, okay? If you had a multi-dimensional key, you could say, I'm looking for a file with name foo, and I want all files that are images. So this is your second, so this is x and this is y. So then you only get files that match foo that are images and not something else. Okay, so basically you can have additional attributes that are used to filter the results. Okay, so you could, this is just two dimensional, but you can generalize this to n dimensions. Okay, you have n dimensional keys. Okay, this is only showing the two dimensional version of what content addressable network does. Okay, is this clear? What the key value lookup there? Okay, so now again, all of the things that we talked about previously you have to now decide how this works. Okay? So which nodes join the, when the node joins the system, what do you take responsibility for? Okay? So what are shown here are rectangles, and what are dots are essentially nodes in the system. And each node basically takes responsibility for all queries that fall in that range. Okay? So the range has a X and a Y range. So this node essentially has taken responsibility for all X values that go from here to here and Y values that go from there to there. Okay? So any lookup in that range is routed to this machine, and that machine has a table, okay, for all of those items, and it has to return back the right results. Okay? So whenever a node joins a system, so this is showing you the picture. Scenario where a node has joined. So a node joins, and let's say the node picks a coordinate that happens to be there. So what happens is this rectangle is now broken into two parts. Okay? And then this range goes to this node, and this range goes to this node. Very similar to what I showed in the previous case, where this whole range got split into two parts when node 10 joined. Okay? And then responsibility for 11 and 12 went to this node, and 8, 9, 10 went here. Now you have to split two-dimensional. In this case, you are taking two dimensions and splitting that ring, and that's done by splitting the rectangle. Okay. And if this node leaves, then you basically take this and hand it back to that node, and the rectangle grows. Okay? Yes. Yeah.
So when you say a node actually splits the entire ring, you're trying to say that the node actually has the data that is within the ring. But what if it does not have it and the other node has it? So what happens when the ring is split?
When the ring is split, all of the responsibility comes to you. You have to somehow get this data from somewhere. Right? So assume that this node had all of the values. You would either get it from there, or you have to send queries and reconstruct this data. Depends on the application. Okay? And the same is true when the node leaves. If that data is not replicated, okay, then the node has to regenerate it somehow. Or if it's replicated, then you get the replicas and then you construct new tables. Okay? So essentially there are two things happening here. There is a table lookup. There's a database which is essentially a table, and you're partitioning responsibility for which queries are answered by whom based on nodes that have joined the system. As more node joins, this database gets split into smaller and smaller chunks, and different nodes take responsibility. This is how you scale up. Okay? That's one thing. The other thing that is also happening is you have an algorithm for deciding who gets responsibility for what. And this is done by picking a coordinate or a value for yourself, and all of the data items that have that range are given to you. Okay, so in this case, if records are numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, and you pick a certain value for yourself, all adjacent records, the responsibility for that comes to you based on your own ID. Okay, these are the two things that are all sort of part of this system. There's some questions on that.
I just want to make sure. So if a new node joins in, and there was a previous node that was taken care of along the huge block. So how does the division happen? Is it based upon data this new node has, or is it just the simple part?
So it depends on, question is, does it split into half? The easiest thing, of course, is to split into half. But if you pick a coordinate, there could be other algorithms for doing that as well.
Sure.
Okay. This is just one system. There are a whole spectrum of them that were built. Okay. Different methods were used in different ways. The interesting thing, though, is not just the joined part, but the leave. Okay. I just showed you a simple example where if this node leaves, this rectangle grows back to its original size again. But if it is split in arbitrary ways, that may not always be possible. So for example, let's assume this node. Okay, this has responsibility for answering queries here. What should happen when that node leaves? Okay. This rectangle doesn't automatically become a bigger rectangle. Right? So you might have to do various things. You could actually then split this rectangle into two and grow one rectangle this way and the other one that way. Or you have to do something else. So it's not always clear in multi-dimensional cases what happens. In single dimension, it is always clear. When a node leaves, the next higher neighbor takes over your responsibility. That's very clear cut. There's no ambiguity there. Okay, but in multi-dimensional things, because rectangles have been constructed in arbitrary ways, depending on where nodes are joined, different things might have to happen. Okay, rectangles are not always half. So you can see this one is smaller than that. Okay, that just shows you an example where it's not always split that way.
So wouldn't it make more sense if the division is based on the data a particular node has?
It could well be, yes. Yeah. Any other questions on this?
Who uses this?
So there are many actually. Skype is a good example of a peer-to-peer system. Okay, in Skype, basically you keep track of who is logged into the system, where they are located. So if you make a Skype call, you go into the Skype system and you do a lookup. Is this person logged in? Okay. So that query is routed to someone who has responsibility for you. So you might have a user ID that might be mapped to a numeric identifier. Okay, somebody has kept track of are you currently logged in or not. And if so, then you have to know where your IP address is, because to make the call, I need to know which machine you are logged in from. Just one example. Okay. I'm not saying Skype uses CORD or CAN, but it is a peer-to-peer system that uses these principles.
But in a peer-to-peer system, you have multiple machines serving for a single block. Here we talked about, say, some data. If this is serving, it is serving to one person.
Yes.
But in a peer-to-peer, you can have 3-4 machines serving one client.
Yeah, so I'll come back to that. So this is just a lookup part of it. Okay? Fetching data is a different issue altogether. Okay? So in this case, for instance, this may be a file. There may be 10 clients that have all copy of this file. What you do once you've gotten back this result is up to you. You may decide that you will actually download the file in parallel. You will pick one of these nodes randomly. You will pick the node with the best bandwidth. That's a different part of the picture. This is only showing you how the lookups are done, not what is done after the results of the lookup are returned to you. Okay. So before I end, I just want to mention unstructured peer-to-peer systems. Okay. So CORD and CAN were examples of structured peer-to-peer systems. Okay. There's another category of peer-to-peer systems called unstructured, and Nutella is a good example of that. Okay. So what happens in this case is, as the name suggests, there is no real structure of what the system topology looks like. Okay. So in the CORD or CAN, the topology of either a ring or a multidimensional array. So in Nutella, you just have nodes that are part of the system. There are arbitrary links going from some nodes to some other nodes. Okay. These are peers that are part of the system currently. Okay. Whenever a node joins, okay, it just picks some other nodes at random and constructs links to them. So they become neighbors of that node. So let's say this is a new node. It basically discovers which peers currently exist in the system, and it may arbitrarily pick this node and say, you are my neighbor. Okay, so now this is the new topology of the system, and system grows in this fashion. So let's say yet another node joins, it picks two or maybe more than two nodes at random and constructs edges to them. And the system keeps growing, won't shrinking. If this node leaves, some links break. Okay? You have to pick multiple neighbors, because if you leave the system, you don't want the network to get partitioned. Okay? You still want the network to stay connected, which is why you pick multiple neighbors. Okay? Now, that's the topology of the system, okay? As opposed to a ring. So this basically is an arbitrary topology that grows out of how nodes are joined and left the system at any given point. Okay, now next question is, how are lookups handled? Okay. In the previous case, you knew which node to go to for a particular query, and that depended on the ID of your query. You route it to the right node, because nodes are particular responsibility. In this case, there is no structure. Okay. So lookups have to be done in a different way, and typically they are done using what is called flooding. This is how early P2P systems work. So suppose this is a peer. Okay, this user is searching for, as I said, file name foo. Okay, it needs to figure out who has this file. Okay, in this system, no particular peer has responsibility for answering this query. Okay, so as a result, query is flooded into the system. Every peer basically sends it out on its link. So this query basically goes on these two links to this node and this node. Okay, so foo. So saying, do you have foo or do you have foo? And then this node is responsible for sending it out on these other two links. So this query propagates through the system, and this will send it this way, and so on. Okay, so you're essentially flooding the system with a message saying, do you have a file with name foo? So a large number of nodes is going to receive this because of the topology of the system. Okay, and then responses come back the other way. Every node has to send back a reply, yes or no. Okay, you could just send yes. If you don't reply, it may be assumed that you don't have it. And these responses are aggregated. They flow back in the reverse direction, and this node essentially gets answers to all its queries. Okay. So what you have essentially done is you are basically going to every node and just asking, do you have this file? And then replies come back to you, and you aggregate them, and you figure out which machines might have it, and then you go and download the file or whatever you want to do with this from those machines. That's how unstructured peer-to-peer systems work. Nutella is a good example of this, yes.
But will the search be time-bound? Because
some sounds like an infinite. Right. So, the question is, how does the search end, and how do you make sure there are no loops and whatnot, right? So, you have to make sure that you only propagate the search along links that you have not yet seen the query. Okay, so, for instance, if the query came to you on this link, you don't send it back on that link. So, that also ensures there is no circularity. Circular loops and whatnot. The other thing that you also do is you have a time to live value that you put on each query, and at each hop you decrement this value by 1. Okay? And when the TTL goes down to 0, you don't forward it anymore. That tells you how deep you want the query to go. If you set it to 100, you can go 100 nodes that are 100 hops away from you. If you set it to 50, the query only propagates to nodes that are up to 50 hops away from you. This is how you can limit the reach of the query into the network. If you have a very large network, you don't want every query to go to every node in the world, but you do want to go to a substantive number of nodes so that you can get some good results from your query. So there are ways to limit it. Again, we will come back to this later on in this course. Yes?
Do you have to keep track of the path? Because even if you don't sense the person above you, you still have the triangle circular loop.
Yes, so you do have to keep track of the path as well.
Unless you send it back to my way too.
Yes, so you need to know where the query came from. Okay, and you may have multiple links, so this query may actually come this way and this way. Right? So this basically this node has received it twice, but if you kept track of the fact that you have already seen it before, okay, queries can have an ID on it. So if you know that I received this query, you don't, it's the second time you receive it, you drop it. You don't forward it again because that doesn't make sense. You know that you have sent it on. Okay, so you have to do all these things to make sure that flooding is expensive, but you don't just take the system down because messages keep circulating. Okay, any questions here? Okay, so we still have a few minutes. So I'm not going to go into this slide in a whole lot detail. All this slide is saying is, although you have on one hand structured peer-to-peer systems, where there is a certain physical topology that could be a ring or a multidimensional array associated with what your network, or an unstructured one where there is no predefined or a priori defined topology. So you have these two categories of peer-to-peer system. What this slide is showing is they are actually not very different. You can take a structured peer-to-peer system and take some of the links and swap them and make it unstructured, or vice versa. You could take an unstructured system. And this is basically just showing you a very dense P2P system where all these things are links that go from node to node. You just eliminate some links or swap them and you get a structure. So you can take this and you can make it into a torus, which is just another form of a structured peer-to-peer system. Okay. So what the book has, and again I'm not going to go into this into detail, is an algorithm by which you can take any unstructured system. Let's take this topology. You delete some links, you add some links in some form that's specified by the algorithm, and you create structure out of this. And then this can be turned into a structured P2P system. This just shows that there is some form equivalence between peer-to-peer system that are both structured and unstructured. Okay, that's all that this basically slide says. And we'll not look at the algorithm that is used to go from one to another. Okay, that's something that if you're interested in, it's in the book, so you can go read it. Okay? But what I do want to say about unstructured systems is the need for some hierarchy in the system. Okay? So if you basically have this kind of system, you can imagine that every time there's a query, it's flooded. Okay? So there are lots of messages that are being exchanged in this system. Okay? And not all nodes may have the capability to process all of these messages. So if you have joined a system, let's say on a low bandwidth link, you may be on a dial-up connection, or you may be on a slower cellular data connection. Okay? So you don't have lots of resources, in this case network bandwidth. So if lots of queries are coming to you saying, do you have these files, and you really don't, you are just processing, wasting a lot of bandwidth, okay, that you do not really have I cannot afford to waste. So how do you address this problem in large unstructured peer-to-peer system? So what people have done is that they have tried to embed some form of a hierarchy from this system. So what happens is you take these peers and you construct groups. So then you basically have this group and this group. Okay. Within each group, you elect a leader. Okay. And this leader is called a super peer. Okay. This could be a machine with more resources than other machines, or a machine that's more stable, not unlikely to disappear. Okay. So once you pick the leader, all queries for members in your group are going to be answered by that leader. Okay. So in this case, black nodes are super peers. Okay. So queries are only flooded between super peers, but they don't go to individual nodes. So what individual nodes do is they tell their super peers saying, I am sharing these files, or these are the data items I have. So the table for all of these, or the index lookup, is actually done here, because this node knows what are the contents of all of these other peers. So whenever a query comes in, it's sent to the closest super peer or the super peer in your group, and then these super peer flood. And this query is sent to all these other super peer via links, and then you get all the results back and you send it back to the peer. Okay, this prevents some degree of flooding. In other words, these nodes don't get query messages. They may get download messages. If you have a popular file and lots of other users are interested in it, lots of them may be trying to download it from you, but you don't have to answer queries for them. Okay? Typically, there are a lot more query messages than download messages, because queries are flooded, but downloads are targeted. Okay. So many systems use this notion of super peers, okay, including Skype. Okay. So in Skype, although it's a peer-to-peer system, not every node has responsibility to answer queries saying, I want to place a call to my friend, where is he located, is he logged in and is he located. Okay. So what Skype does is it has an algorithm to elevate certain Skype nodes to become super peers. So if you are on a good machine, good bandwidth connection, you may suddenly discover that Skype has made you a super peer. Okay, you will not know this typically. The only way you know this is basically there may be more traffic coming to you. Okay, and then what happens then is that your Skype app actually now has information about some other users in the system, whether they're logged in, what are their current IP addresses, and if someone else is interested in making a call or does a search, then you have to answer some queries. So early versions of Skype used to do this. Now Skype has put their own machines as some of their super peers. So they have their own dedicated servers that also allow you to do this lookup. So you don't have to depend on users to contribute services. But some machines might nevertheless become super peers in regions where there aren't any super peers nearby. Okay. So that's basically. So let me just talk about one more thing and then I'm going to stop. And this is just the notion of what are called edge server system. Okay. So this is a generalization from what is called a client server model to what is called a client proxy server model. Okay. The typical client server model is a client and there's a server. Clients make requests and servers respond to requests. Okay. And this is fine in many scenarios. But there are scenarios where it is also advantageous to add an additional machine in the picture called a proxy server. Okay, the proxy server typically acts as a cache or an intermediary for the real server. Okay. So rather than the client contacting the server directly, the client actually sends its request to the proxy. And the proxy can see whether it can service this request or not. If it can service the request, then the response goes back from the proxy. If not, you send it back to the server. Okay. Now the biggest use of this is to deploy a network of web caches that cache web pages. Okay. So you might have proxy servers that are caching web pages from popular servers. So your browser doesn't actually go to the main server, it actually goes to a nearby proxy and says, I want the CNN web page, okay, http://cnn.com. If the proxy has cached it, okay, somebody else had retrieved it not too long ago, you have it in your cache, you can just return the page back to the user. What this does is it reduces the load on the real server. So because some of the requests are being processed by proxies, and also if the proxy is closer to the client than the server itself, okay, then the replies come back to the client faster than going to a far off server, a distant server. Okay. So there are these are referred to edge server systems, and we'll come back to this and talk about it next time. Okay. But just keep this in mind. This client server model is generalized to what's called the client proxy server model. Okay. So let's stop here for today. We will resume next week.